In case you haven't heard, it's officially an Abercrombie summer. The A&F Vacation Shop has everything on your packing mood board. I desperately need their new one piece, the A&F Marina. It's strapless, so flattering, and paired with denim shorts will be my go-to beach outfit this summer. Finally, your suitcase isn't complete without finding that dress. You know, the one for the photo shoot. Abercrombie's boho dresses have that perfect beachy romantic look. Make it an Abercrombie summer. Shop their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail. Companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of my podcast this week is Dean Gaeta, CEO of Infragistics.
There's nothing like the fear of going out of business to stick in your brain. How can you do this better next time? And what it comes down to is really early investment is making bets on the future where you think the future is. And spending your money there, even though if you, like I report to a board now, but even if you report to others how they want to have better financial performance, you have to always keep investing in the future and refreshing your technology. And like, there's this great analogy that software is like lettuce. It, as soon as you like have it, it's already wilting.
This is Dean. He's got over 34 years of experience as the CEO and founder of Infragistics, a user interface development tools platform, and an expert in user-centric design. He scaled the business globally across 6 countries with a client roster that includes 100% of the S&P 500. What is special is that he guided Infragistics to withstand a series of tumultuous moments in the internet's ongoing evolution. Think about the dot-com tech bubble of the late 90s, the explosion of the internet, and the 2008 recession. That he survived was not because he was lucky, or happened to be in the right place at the right time, or worked harder than the next guy. He did it by crystallizing the insight at each key moment along the way, from common growing pains to completely unpredictable challenges, all into a hard-won philosophy. All his lessons are now bundled in his new book, When Grit Is Not Enough. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Dean to my podcast. We explore an inspiring journey of resilience of running a successful software business for more than 34 years. Dean talks about his near failures and shares the big lessons that he learned to come out stronger again and again. He digs into the fundamentals to build a resilient software business and how he is incorporating that into the day-to-day work so it's lived to its fullest. And by listening to his podcast, you will learn 4 things. Firstly, how to achieve the financial resilience to be able to don't fall behind. Secondly, what to prioritize to ensure culture stays healthy and everyone stays on track with the direction. Thirdly, what are the 2 simple instruments that Dean uses to navigate tough times? And lastly, how to build trust in periods where you have to lay off people. Well, hi, Dean. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So, just before kind of starting this podcast, we had a little bit of a chit-chat, and going back 300 episodes in right now, I think you are the CEO that has managed to lead a company the longest of all guests on the podcast, which have, of course, been around 300 right now. So congratulations with that. I know how hard it is. I used to come from a company that had started in the 80s as well. And if you look at that journey over the last 35, 40 years, all the technology ways, which of course is fun, but it's extremely hard to sustain. And so I'm really happy to have you on the podcast and to go through that journey and get a couple of the big lessons. We'll likely also kind of dive into your new book, or into your book, because this is the first one, When Grit Is Not Enough. So it's going to be a promising episode, this one. So before we start talking about your company, looking at yourself, what drives you? What gives you energy as a tech entrepreneur?
Well, I mean, I like always learning. And so that's what I love about the tech space. I get a lot of joy out of learning and figuring things out and working with others, just collaborating to figure out different ways to solve problems or create something new. So that drives a lot of what I do. I get great enjoyment out of just interacting and learning new things.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was talking about my book, Trade Number 4, that defines remarkable software companies is they master the art of curiosity. And I think curiosity and learning is very close to each other. It's this ongoing desire to get what's out there, how it works, what's new, what can we do. I mean, it proves again, the learning has stayed ahead of you because you've mastered to get through almost 3-4 decades right now and stay very relevant to the marketplace. That's what is required. Yeah, exactly. So making the bridge then to your company, when you started the company, what was the big problem that you saw back then that was screaming for a solution like the one you started building back then?
Yeah, well, I was a freelance consultant working at different enterprises and down on Wall Street. And we were building software with, as you know, it's going way back, but we were building DOS software on some of the first laptops, Data General, and our back end was IBM CICS DB2. And so we were trying to make it, beautiful, transactional, good experience. And it was just when Windows 2.0 was coming out. And so there was a lot of challenge going from procedural programming to event-driven programming. And it's unbelievable how much innovation has happened since then. But just to share with the audience, like going from Windows 2.0 to Windows 3.0, the big innovation was overlapped windows. I mean, that was the big user experience innovation. Yeah. So what started it was that we were working on this product for actually AIG, and it was in DOS. And we said, hey, we should build a toolkit for developers building in a Windows environment. And so we set out and built actually custom controls in Windows 2.0. And then we were going to go to market, but everyone was having a very hard time learning Windows programming. And they were reading this big 400-page Charles Petzl book. And we're like, okay, we can't go to market, even though it's going to be helpful for people, and say you have to learn like 300 new APIs. And so before we went to market, we created the custom controls to create screens and do the UI in Windows. But then we wrote tooling where you can visually build your menus, your screens, and we generated C code. There wasn't even C++ back then. So we started generating Pascal and C++. But that was our initial idea, was that, okay, let's help the Windows developer build business applications, do data entry validations, and let's help them be productive in building out business type Windows applications.
Yeah. Well, the problem is still the same. It still needs to be done. I think what has changed for a big, on the UI, it's always evolving. And of course, UI is always a matter of like what the new norms are. And at some point when I left Unit 4, the saying was the best UI is no UI, which of course is bad for your business. it's come a long way. And of course, everything happened sort of in the background with all the infrastructure that is whereby these days you can actually almost build an enterprise level application in a couple of weeks or months even. So great learning from there. We don't have to go through the kind of the typical question like what's the opportunity if you get this right. Everyone understands that. But what I'm interested is, and that may be also kind of tied to your book, When Grit Is Not Enough. You already mentioned DOS, and then you mentioned that it had to be Windows, and that was I came from that area as well. Massive innovation. Then came the jump to the internet. Everything needed to be browser based, and we know all the companies out there that made it and didn't make it. I mean, in my world, PeopleSoft stayed on for Windows clients for so long, and at the end didn't survive. You know, Workday came out of that, and see where they are these days. What is a learning that you got from that era that's still super relevant for how you manage the business today?
Yeah, well, the first big technology shift, we almost went out of business, and it was a real shocker how to transition, because as you mentioned, like in the tech space, it takes a long time to build product, a year, 2 years. And then when technology shifts to a new platform, and us being in the software developer tool space, we have to rebuild our technology and then have add value on top of the platform. And so it's quite a journey, and it was very shocking financially to us to make that first switch. And there's nothing like the fear of going out of business to stick in your brain, how can you do this better next time? And what it comes down to is really early investment is making bets on the future, where you think the future is, and spending your money there, even though if you, like I report to a board now, but even if you report to others how they want to have better financial performance, you have to always keep investing in the future and refreshing your technology. And like, there's this great analogy that software is like lettuce. It, as soon as you like have it, it's already wilting. And so you have to always keep ahead and innovating. And so that's kind of like a big lesson that we had to like survive all these 35 years of keep reinventing our tech for every new platform or UI or device.
Let me make a small interruption here. Dean just made a critical remark that underpins the resilience of his software business. Never stop working on the refreshing of your technology. And here's the thing. The world always keeps changing, and it will catch up with you faster than you can plan for. Before you know it, you're behind, not only technology-wise, but also financial performance-wise. And then it's impossible to make the right move. And this is a trait remarkable software companies master. They master the art of curiosity. Then they focus on the essence, and then change when they're at the top of their strength to build new value possibilities and start new S-curves. With that, they keep momentum going, and you can master these traits as well. The first step? Simply sign up to my daily email. How? Simply go to valueinspiration.com/daily. Back to the interview.
And there's more to it than that, but that's kind of like a big lesson.
Completely agree. I mean, one of the big questions that I always used to struggle with, not only because I was pushing things to kind of make that investment going forward, but then there's the other parts of the business that say, you know, what do we have to do? Do you have to rebuild the whole thing? Then we cannot go on and sell the other thing. So we always try to stay on and use the existing code for longer and longer and longer, even though you sometimes already know we've gone into a dead end road. So yeah, how do you, I mean, you have to kind of take a rip off the Band-Aid almost. But yeah, especially I think also in the UI world, it's very often starting from scratch because it's definitely a new era. So how do you make those almost life-changing, company-changing type of decisions, bets?
So some of the, like our kind of, what I say, I talk in front of our company once a month and I write to the company usually once a week in our Slingshot forum, which is one of our products. And I always talk about simple and beautiful. So like our purpose and vision is like to create simplicity and beauty in the world one app at a time. But it's core, like when you keep saying it and give examples of how can we make this simple? How can we make this beautiful? It has so much value. It's so easy to say, so hard to do. So that's kind of our core values. And it does transcend beyond the product, but it's very much a product vision. Like, how can we help our customers build simple and beautiful experiences digitally? And when you do that, and when you realize how much emotional and happiness and energy and people's appreciation for whether you're using a business app or some other app, simplicity and beauty really matters. And that's kind of like a high level point of view that you keep saying that, then all your team start thinking about that and to keep improving and trying to achieve that effect. So it doesn't answer your question directly, but I guess the other way to answer your question directly is that you have to make bets. Like, we've made bets that were wrong, and we made more bets that were right. So we've bet on a lot of different frameworks and started building, investing that never took off, and that were even from Microsoft that, you know, we've had this long relationship with Microsoft where, like, we built all the database binding technology for Microsoft and Internet, their first Internet Explorer. We were really close with Microsoft for all the years of their developer tools division. But we've made bad bets where we've invested in some UI frameworks from them that just didn't take off for them. But but you have to still make those bets, you know, and bring the team along.
Yeah.
And one of the nice things about technology is that there's a long life to old technology, but you have to shift resources to build the next generation to stay relevant. So it's that balance. Take care of your current tech, take care of your customers, but make the bets and start investing early.
Yeah, I mean, I like what you're saying there. Because you haven't said to anybody, we're in the UI business or in the UI tool business. You have to create something that's simple and beautiful. It doesn't Yes. mention the tool. So it doesn't constrain you in terms of open thinking. And then combined with creating a learning organization that's curious, then those people that take that to heart, they're always out there. Okay, how can we make it even more simple and more beautiful? And that's how they're exploring the new things earlier than anybody else, because that's where yeah. the passion comes from. Yeah, beautiful. But at the end, it's you know, there's big decisions connected to that. And it's always easy to make those decisions when you are growing and at your top, when you are at your strongest point, rather than when things are going down and revenue stays behind, the costs have to be in line with the revenue to make a profit, because that's where it really gets tough. That's where yes. companies start to fail. Exactly. Very interesting. Now, what has been the toughest decision that you had to make on this journey? Possibly one of those life and death situations. What did you learn from that?
Yeah, some of the hardest decisions is when you have to adjust your P&L and your expense structure, like having to lay off people. And that does happen. It's happened to us 3 times in 35 years. You try and minimize it, but it has to do with what you said. What happens is that you're growing, and then technology changes and you're growing. And then all of a sudden, the speed of your growth and your top line is inhibitor, because now you have to, like, everyone starts shifting to a new technology, and then your sales start going down. And so you have to backfill with new sales on a new technology, which may or may not be ready yet. And then all of a sudden, trying to keep even at revenue is hard. It's like just trying to, because you have to backfill like great growth on an older, you know, technology, and now things shifted. And so some of the most difficult decisions I've always had to make is laying off people. But you can do it the right way, which is you have to, like, as a leader, you know, work with your team to figure out, make the best decisions who you have to lay off. And then, you know, do it in one day. Like, we've learned that, like, you don't do it over time. Make the shock happen once. Talk to everyone the same day, the people that you have to lay off and the people that are staying. Like, the leader has to talk to everybody and tell them why, and just be real about why. And give them money too. Like, do your best to give them enough landing cushion. And the reason wasn't because of them, it was because of business, you know? And so that's kind of been, like, you know, always a hard thing.
I completely agree with you. And I love the way you're treating that. It says a lot about you and what the business stands for. That's going to be a company I'd love to work for. Because, yeah, it is about business and not personal, of course. And it's always hard. But there's always, it's at the end about how do you deal with it that gives people a bad feeling or a good feeling. And better deal with this, that people get, yeah, keep a good feeling about what's happened rather than the other way around. Had any of those moments to do with crisis in the market, or was it something else?
Yeah, I mean, we've been through, I don't know how many recessions, and our first recession was another big shock to us. We got better and better. And, like, I write about it in the book, how to, like, deal with this, how to yeah. create, like, this fabric of resiliency. And, like, what I write about in the book, I wish I would have read it or had that knowledge, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, because, like, go-to-market planning, OKRs, strategic planning, annual planning really matters. So like when you do a strategic plan and you do it over 3 years, you're showing the business where you're going to invest and deinvest and why in the future, why these decisions are happening, because you're executing towards some three-year goal of whether you're changing product, sales or marketing, go to market, whether you're doing sales-led growth, product-led growth, some hybrid. But it actually shows the team and others, you have to keep informed why you're making some of your decisions. And you show it both financially, like here's where we think our sales are going to be, here's where we're going to spend our money. And then you do it also like at a strategic level, like, okay, here's our, you know, three core product strategies. Here's a couple of our operational strategies. And it allows you to build those muscles, because a lot of times, or most of the time in these strategic plans, you may not have the product, you may not have the skill, you may not have the people, but you're showing how you're going to build that muscle and how it's going to be a little bit painful, but there's where you're going. And that really helps out a lot of people making short and long-term decisions. And then the other key part of it is like we have a 12-month P&L and cash flow forecast, which actually liberates me to take way more risk. And it gives me the levers to understand decisions now. How's that going to hit cash? How's that going to hit expense structure? And by having this 12-month forecast of our P&L and our cash flow, and then we update it with actuals each month, it allows you to take a lot more risk. And so these are like mechanics that really, really help you have resilience.
Yeah, the resilience is a very important one. I'm actually writing a book about the same type of topics. You know, how do you not only survive a crisis, but actually come out stronger? So about that question, I'd love to get your answer on that. Have you been able to come out stronger out of every crisis that is there? And what was fundamental to that?
Yeah, I mean, what crises always do to you is they make you, they sharpen your focus, Shorten your objectives, get really oversensitive to where you spend your time and priorities and resources. So in a lot of ways, it makes you a much more efficient machine, but a lot of pain comes with it. So, you know, crisis comes with pain. And one of the things I haven't talked about, which is critical, is like people are the most important thing to any company. And so like there's these fundamental things of culture and trust and people understanding objectives and making sure people are aligned on what you're doing. And so much of it has to do with communication and also reinforcing things, but also listening and understanding and taking input. So crisis just like makes everything matter more. Everything is so much more intense. So I think when you come out of a crisis, if you do it well, you bond closer with your whole team, your whole company. Yeah. You kind of have a shared experience of challenge, and you definitely get more focused and do less. So you're actually executing better, but then you start to do more again. That's just the natural cycle.
Exactly. That's interesting what you say, you know, more focused and do less. And a lot of people think it's always about doing more, but I think the focus is a critical one. And yes, for some reason in a crisis, it gets you, well, that's my trait number 7 in my book, focus on the essence. And beyond, when there's no crisis, when everything is sort of okay, you know, you get sloppy around things. And it's very hard to get your finger behind. It's got to do with complacency in the organization. You tell yourself stories about how great you are, how good you are, until it's not.
So yes. It's,
and that's where, things get overexcited. And that's where often layoffs come from, because then you have to kind of really cut deep in order to correct course. Fascinating. In your book, you're always also writing about, you know, that whole aspect of culture and how important that is. And particularly, don't avoid tough conversations. I love that part. Yeah. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, that's critical to building a high-performing team, a high-performing company. Yeah. Because what happens is no manager, no matter how skilled you are, likes to have these conversations. But if you avoid it, you're basically, it does so much damage. One, if you don't have those tough conversations with the individual, they don't know how to course correct. They don't, And there's this thing I learned at the Center for Creative Leadership called situation behavior impact, which is so powerful. So like you say, here was a situation, here was your behavior, and here's the impact. It creates a lot more grounding in for someone to realize what's going on. And but without having tough conversations, you don't help someone get better. You don't help someone create awareness around something. And then more importantly, the rest of the team is always watching you. So whether you know it or not, everyone's watching the manager, everyone's watching the leaders, 24/7, constantly judging you. And so if it's okay for someone to get away with some bad behavior and you're not having those tough conversations, all of a sudden people start saying, I don't care either then. That's right. And then you lose A players and you create this bad toxic work environment, which is like, okay, you say we care and we want to do these things, but you know, you're not having those tough conversations when you need to. And it's some of the hardest things to train VPs, managers. Don't think VPs do this great either, by the way. It's like, it's always hard. It's hard for people that are doing it, but so you have to have that bravery and you have to do it. It's so important. And you have to teach managers how to do it well and how to do it in a, then there's a lots of process and techniques in there, which is don't assume, you know, situation behavior impact is really good, but also don't assume. Like I've made mistakes in my career where one person comes to me and they tell me the story and I trust the person, but actually I didn't get the whole correct story. And so you can't always assume what's going on until you be very open to hearing everything before you do something. But for me, it's really critical to run high performing teams in a company and have everyone in it together and be respectful. And this always happens. Like you always have behavior problems, whether intentional or non-intentional. It's just human nature. And so it's part of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's also the essence here is not having high performing individuals, but a high performing organization.
Yes.
That means about how are we high performing together?
Yes.
Because if you have 100 high performing individuals and you have an organization that has 50 high performing people working together, I think these will even outperform the hundreds.
100%. Yeah,
exactly. And that's the issue here because, like you say, people see it and they see the behavior and at some point they don't care. And then, you've lost that war. So I really like that. And also in relation to the resilience part, because like yourself, I've also seen how this works because when you do this, it creates trust and it creates bonding.
Yes.
And then those people will stand up for each other when the going gets tough and they help each other and get you through it. And that is beautiful for an organization. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. Like trust is something you have to always work at. And like when you have these tough conversations, you always do it in private. And then, I mean, then the opposite of it, which is you have to work hard at it. It's so easy to be critical and to find problems because that's just easy. But like how you keep praising, like praise good behavior, praise good things, and keep doing that publicly. And that has a more positive impact of changing what people do and how they're appreciated and to actually get them to keep doing the same good thing. And so like as all managers and leaders, I mean, you should just, and it's hard work, and it has to be real. But you constantly need to praise people publicly, give them real examples of why they did a good job or a good result. And that's probably more important than tough, not more important, but a critical part of the opposite of tough conversations.
It's both. It's the balance. I completely agree. I mean, I recently had Johnny White from the CEO of Ticket Taylor on my podcast. He was talking about the same thing. He was talking about the currency of positivity and how that becomes your flywheel. So how do you, I mean, I'm not sure whether you were talking about it in your book or whether it was someone else, but how do you ensure that this is really happening? Have you got a framework for that?
Yeah. I mean, a framework for that you're ensuring that people are using positivity and recognizing.
That it becomes part of the DNA.
I think a lot has to do with leaders in the company. Like people watch the leaders and then they mimic the leaders. So you really need to, like for me, I need to make sure that my own team is doing it. And we have processes around, you know, monthly we nominate peer nomination of representing innovation, customer delight, you know, it's like five core things.
Yeah.
That helps. That's a process. But I would say the most important thing is that your leadership team, you keep doing it, and then others will mimic it. And then we have a coaching process every year at Infragistics, and we separate raises from coaching because they're two different things, because raises have to do with company can afford to give you more money. You know, raises has to do with, you know, different than coaching. So in coaching, it's like, okay, well, no matter what, we want to invest in you. We want you to keep learning, keep getting better. And so part of that process too, if you're a manager, you know, maybe some of the things you should work on is, you know, how do you motivate the team through real recognition publicly when people do things good? And you have to do it a lot, and it works amazing. But mainly, like at least for us, like there's a coaching process. There's this, we call it our Iggy Award. But I think the most important thing is that your leadership do it and do it a lot. And you remind them of it, you know? And that's really mean. And it has to be meaningful. Like you can't say, oh, great job on that podcast when you're like, yeah, I did an okay day with my podcast. No, maybe you did an amazing day. And people want to hear real compliments, you know? So you got to be real about it and public. So it's, you want to do it publicly and you want to tell stories. So like I have forums to get in front of the company, you know, once a month. And I always try to tell stories, like, because people can relate to that. And so a story, why someone took care of a customer, or a story, how someone did, you know, built some great piece of software, or a story, why a designer created something beautiful, a story, how someone won a sale. But tell real meaningful stories. And yeah, people love that. So the people that did it love it. And the people that are listening to it also appreciate them and say, oh, this is what's important to us.
Exactly. Going back to your mission, create something simple and beautiful. The moment you can package that into stories about what that means at every level in the company, then you start to kind of live the vision. Otherwise, it just stays something like a plaque on your wall.
Yeah. Yeah. Every month, every month I talk about simplicity and beauty. And then I give examples of it and just keep doing it and doing it. And what's amazing is like our employees will repeat it. And then our customers are repeating it, which is unbelievable. Like a customer says, oh, I like your Reveal embedded BI product. It's so beautiful. And we're like, yes. You know, it's like, when you start hearing it back. And so, yeah, you just keep telling stories about it.
Exactly. That's the way to do it. Because it's so simple, the way you can explain it. I mean, I even memorize it. I can actually pass it on to someone else. That's the beauty of it. I see so many companies that create this vision statement and mission statement, and it's like 20 words, 50 words. So, yeah,
so
everything
hard.
Needs to be in there. And yes, just keep it simple and beautiful.
Yeah, keep it simple. Yeah, and you know what? It's funny. I do write about in the book, like, oh, we went down that path. Okay, what's our mission? Okay, what's our purpose? Okay, what are our core goals? And like, even us that created it could never get it right. It's like, okay, what's the difference between our purpose and mission? What's the difference between our vision and our goals? Like, it's so I'm like a believer in like, just talk about your vision and purpose. And keep it simple. Otherwise, no one can even remember all these different pieces. And then like at Infragistics, we have like four now, but main mission, which is basically our big objectives. But that's it. It's just vision and purpose, and then these core objectives. And I say it every company meeting. So it's so important to keep it simple, because people won't, even your execs won't be able to say it right, even if they came up with it. It's so confusing. And so there's an MBA that's not good for execution. You know, like, it's too much.
Exactly. Yeah. There's so many examples of when you think everybody's aligned and then someone from the outside is asking every member of your management team, what are the goals for this year? And they all come up with something different.
Yeah.
And it's eye-opening. All right. Looking at the time, I got a couple of questions that I still want to ask. Having gone through these cycles, these waves of technology, the big changes in what the world required from a UI building perspective, You've already talked about, okay, you got product one, and then suddenly that is going slowing down, and you need to start your next S-curve with a new product line. What have you learned from introducing these new product lines over the years in terms of creating momentum? What has been fundamental for that?
Well, one thing that was like, it won't answer your question directly, but then I'll answer your question directly, is that we early on, maybe our first 10 years, we were like an engineering tools company. And then we made this huge shift to be a design and engineering, where we really cared about user experience and the whole UX process. And we started bringing in that kind of talent, which did transform our company from being just a tools company to really thinking about the impact our technology has on who's using it and how to improve that. But in terms of go-to-market, what's critical that we've learned is I'm a big believer in an annual plan, but if you have more than one product, like a go-to-market plan just for that one product, and then making a decision whether it's going to be sales-led growth, product-led growth, a hybrid of the two, and then really understanding your product market fit, which can be more than one if you're a mature product. If you're a new product, you have to be patient. Like, you can't overinvest in sales and marketing until you understand product market fit. And product market fit is so easy to define, so hard to discover. So it's like when you have that perfect use case for that right segment of the market, whether it's an industry, a size of company, a title, that there's clearly a problem and a benefit to what you're solving, it's critical. And so when introducing new products, like, the pressure of trying to scale and get sales and drive more leads, you have to be patient. And so you have to figure out product market fit. But the cycles of like go to market is just that. Like, are we going to be transactional? Are we going to be, you know, like for us, we have a transactional piece, which is digital marketing, SEO, content, product led. But then we also have an enterprise piece, which is a little bit longer sales cycle, account-based marketing. And so, you know, going to market, it's so important to understand the problems you're solving, talking about the problems you're solving. Your messaging is about problem solving, not features. Again, which is really easy for me to say, so hard to do, including us, like,
exactly,
always working at it. And but there's like fundamental mechanics that you do when you go to market.
Yeah, exactly.
And then one last thing to add is it's also important to segment, right? So like really understand, you know, what vertical, what size industry, what demographics, what titles and what problems, and be very focused in your messaging and target, because that's the way to be effective in your sales and marketing spend and increase your customer journey and close cycle.
Yeah. I mean, I see that you got product-led growth, which is typically, of course, a bottom-up approach whereby you have the users, the developers that buy a license to your software. But in the sales-led growth motion, of course, you deal with more management angles that oversee a large group of developers and so on. That, of course, requires a completely different way of positioning it, of messaging it. How do you go about that?
Yeah, well, we've had some really big, very long enterprise relationships. Like Morgan Stanley is probably our longest one. But I was just in Japan, and for the last 7 years, all of Japan's subways and bullet trains are running on our software. And so when you're selling to the enterprise, you need mature salespeople and executives that can talk to other executives and do a deal and understand that. But you never just do a big deal. It's always bottom up at some point. Like, everyone starts small, you know? And so for us, it's a combination of both. Like, product-led growth, transactional is where you try and just, you know, have no touch, you know, sales process. And a lot has to do with like actually PR and affiliate sites and people recommending you, and you have a good brand. And then you enable the people to learn your product as quick as possible to try it out and understand it and get the value quickly. But then, yeah, when you do enterprise selling, for us, it's different. Like, we'll have account-based marketing. We have tools for that. And then we have, you know, AEs. And so it is a different and a longer sales cycle. But half our business is enterprise and half is transactional.
Yeah, exactly. That's completely different motions.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, is there any way you support the developers of your software to share the beautiful work that they've created?
It's so hard. This is unbelievable still to me. We have customers that have been with us for 10, 15 years, and they spend $100,000-$150,000 a year with us. And I want to talk to them, and our top architects want to talk to them, and our heads of development want to talk to them. And they're like, no, we don't want to talk to you. We're like, everything's fine. We're like, we all want to come talk to you. Like, it's so hard. Like, things just are going. They don't want to be, like, at least in the developer space, like, leave me alone. Everything's fine. We're building software. Everything's fine. And so there's that challenge, you know. It's like, it's unbelievable to me. It's like they'll benefit from having conversations with our top people, but nope. They don't want to be bothered. And we ask them every year, sometimes two or three times a year. So it's always a constant fight to like have our customers talk to us. It's like an ongoing battle.
So how do you get people to talk about you?
That's even harder, you know. So like we do case studies. So every time we do a deal, we try and get that in the deal to allow us to use your name and do a case study. And yeah, maybe we'll give you a discount or we'll give you something else. But a lot of big enterprises, they don't care. They don't want, you can't use our brand. You can't talk about us. We love you, but you can't talk about us. And so that's a constant thing because all customers or new prospects want to hear case studies and hear about other people. So we're always working at that. I mean, I think these affiliate sites help out, but it's an ongoing work effort for us. We're always trying to do it, but it's hard. It's hard work.
Yeah, and it's not that you are like that they are sharing their crown jewels, you know, their big company secrets. You know, this is just a UI tool.
Yep.
So, I mean, if you would say, okay, this is about cybersecurity, and we're using this tool and this tool and this tool, and now we're safe. Yeah, I can understand that people are going to hack you, but
yeah, it's all the lawyers. They just and the people they like. Yeah. Look, it doesn't help me to associate my brand with you, you know. Yeah. But then we do get a lot of people say yes, but it's a lot of people don't want to talk about it, exactly. Or they don't want to let you do it.
All right. Well, two more questions. In those years that you've now been running the company, are you doing anything specific to ensure that you're creating something that's, I've been talking about my book, something remarkable, but something that creates lasting impact?
Yeah, that comes down to like creating a learning organization. So like you could hire for people that like to learn, and you could say, hey, what did you read in the last 12 months? Like what do you want to like learn in the next 12 months?
And good point.
There's ways to hire people that love to learn.
Yeah.
And then there's processes too, like growth hacking, where like I call it in my book, the scientific method of driving business outcomes. There's a book written about growth hacking, but it's where you create hypothesis about what's going on based on data, create an experiment to test it, measure that experiment. And if it worked, keep doing it. If it worked a little bit, do that. But it's a process where you're constantly trying to, like, it's so easy to have data and metrics. It's hard to understand why something's happening. So
Exactly. You're
constantly trying to figure out why is that happening. And so there's like a process too to create a learning organization. And then it's culture too. Like if you hire these designers and developers and executives that want to build something great and appreciative, you know, it comes down to that too. It's always about the people, but there's processes and the ways you run your company that create that data learning, agile organization. And that's what my book's a lot about, create a data-driven, agile learning organization. A product that we just put out there that's not a developer tool is called Slingshot, which helps you drive a data-driven, agile learning organization by bringing all your analytics, project management, chat, and having that fluid way of, okay, here's insight on data. Let's collaborate about why that's happening. Let's try and improve it.
Yeah.
So like it's a whole fabric, but when you have a good culture like that, innovation does happen. People step up. Great things get built. It's like creating that whole fabric. It's not like one person.
No, exactly. And I think that's why I like your answer on that, because it's something that you do together again. And it's challenging people to ask the right questions and be curious about, like you say, why is this happening? And what can we do to change course here? Last question then. Out of your wealth of experience being the CEO of the company, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you, now that you know it, would love to share with other people, things that you would have loved to know about 10 years ago?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, so to try and simplify it, I mean, do take care of your people. Like, always think about your people and always think about how you get work done. Always think about how people are working together and just try and create the best environment for people to be relaxed, feel like, and they're in their own home. You know, like I even talk about my book, like food is a big thing, eating together.
Yeah, I saw this.
You know, being real with each other. Like we start every executive team meeting, you share something personal. Like we meet once a week and it's unbelievable. You don't have to share a big or a little thing. It's up to you, but it's unbelievable how much you bond with people when you kick a meeting off, everyone just shares one quick thing personal. And so it's all about the people and creating the environment, how everyone interact. That's like a huge do.
Exactly. I love that in your book here.
A don't is like you really have to understand your financial picture. Like, so don't think someone else is like, maybe you have a great CFO, but no, if you're the leader, like you need to know sales forecast, cash burn or cash creation, expense structure, because that's fundamental to how you make decisions to do or don't do something. So don't delegate that, even though your CFO will give that to you, but you need to be on top of that.
Yeah, exactly. Wise advice. Because once the cash flow thing, you know, is there, you can make the decision, is it big or bigger or a little bit less big, whatever it is. But you do it in context of what the rest is doing, in context of where the market is going, in context of what you're already building, rather than an individual budget. Because then people think, okay, I've got my budget, now I can do whatever I want. No, it has to be in line with what the rest is doing.
Yeah, and it's very dynamic. Like you have, that's where agility comes in, where you can constantly increase, decrease, move around. Like you need, but you need to have that basic structure to see where things are at, so that you can have those conversations.
Exactly. Yeah, and I also like your first one, you know, because it is about people, and these people have to work together day in, day out, often see each other more than their own family. So yeah, make it feel like a family. I like your point about, you know, relaxed. Because in a lot of businesses, particularly in the B2B SaaS world, that word relaxed is almost like non-existent, because there's always pressure, especially with the companies that have taken huge VC funding on and now are in big trouble because the valuation, they cannot meet it anymore. But
there's a huge problem with that, because like I'm not saying VC is bad or good, but here's what it will do to you. It'll make you make decisions and run a company unnaturally, just unnaturally, because it's growth at all costs. And so like, if you can figure out how to take money, but like grow fast, but also organically, like the proper way of creating a culture and teams and yeah, we're all have pressure, but like, yeah, you do better work when you're relaxed. So it is about performance by being relaxed. Those CEOs that take money, they have an extra level of burden. Even though they have more money, they have a harder time building a company.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you very much for sharing all the wisdom. I could talk for another hour with you or two. So where can people go to find out more about Infragistics or to say hi to you?
Yeah, well, you can go to infragistics.com and there's different product sites for our UI tools and our app builder and Slingshot and Reveal, our embedded analytics product. And then there's also now a website called deangaida.com, which is where my book is. So they can interact with me there. And I like to interact with people, by the way. So if you write me on LinkedIn or anywhere, like I like to talk to people. And it's unbelievable how many people don't want to talk to you. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. It's nuts. So I would love to talk to people, but deangaida.com.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I would say I'll continue to follow you on your next step of your journey, and it's going to be a long journey as far as I can see right now. Good luck.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Great questions.
It was a pleasure. And this ends my conversation with Dean, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thanks for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Dane Gaida, CEO of Infragistics. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.